89.1 Dubuque Jesus, the Moon, WGZS, as we like to welcome to our studios here. And, of course, I have the update of the Climate Change Resiliency Project. And we have with us Courtney Kowalczyk from the Environmental Institute Director of the Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College. Yes. Welcome.
Hello.
And we also have with us in the studio here Carlin Ekman. Carlin, I'm not familiar with your title yet, but you want to share, give the listeners as well a little insight on your background.
Sure. I'm a research associate at the University of Minnesota, and I work in the College of Ag and on the St. Paul campus. Mm-hmm. And I've been working on projects up in this part of Minnesota for a number of years now. So I have a lot of colleagues and friends in this part of the state.
And we also have Toshi with us here. Is that right? Or some people say Toshi.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. To share some information as well. And, of course, this all leads back as we take a kind of a, not a giant step, but also a backward step towards 2012 and what happened in, you know, 4 years ago and close to this time frame as well regarding the climatic events of the area that we had here and the amount of rain that we had too. And of course, do they just still call the flood of 2012, or is there a new term for that now?
Well, I think we just call it the flood of 2012 because I think it's still so fresh in everybody's mind, even though it is 4 years mm-hmm. ago, that you just say the flood of 2012 and everybody still knows what you're talking about.
And that gave us a lot of rain. Some places, 10, 11 inches or so. What was the big amount then, Carlin, that you experienced?
Yeah, I think it was up to 12 inches in some mm-hmm. locations. Of course, it depended on where you were.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
As to how much you got. Certainly here on the Fond du Lac Reservation, having so much wetland, the soils were already saturated and all that water could no longer be filtered through the system. So it just began to back up throughout the watershed and people ended up with flooded homes and road mm-hmm. washouts, culverts being washed out. Down in Duluth, nature of the flood was a little different. There were flash floods that went through the neighborhoods and the streams throughout the city, but the Fond du Lac neighborhood of Duluth down by Chambers Grove experienced a different kind of a flood because the forebay of the Thompson Dam failed and that sent a lot of water through that neighborhood, and those folks had a much longer lingering flood than much of the rest of the region did.
Carlin, if you'd be so kind as to give our listeners a little background to that situation with Minnesota Power and the
dam itself.
Mm-hmm.
There was Minnesota Power took some extraordinary steps the night of the heavy rains and had their employees out on the dam itself trying to shore it up. They have a really interesting publication on their website that tells the story of the extraordinary steps that their staff took in order to keep that dam safe. And I'm not an engineer by any means, but I understand that dams are designed to get rid of excess water, and that's what happened. And it's a good thing that the forebay did fail and not the main dam, because the consequences could have been much worse. But the dam did hold, and the amazing thing is that throughout this entire extreme weather event that nobody died. I mean, the outcome could have been different, but fortunately, no lives were lost.
All right, we're here with Courtney and again, Carlin as well, talking about the climate change and the resiliency project. And of course, you've did some extensive look back and of course, to mm-hmm. talk to each of the communities as well.
Right. So really this whole project started because Minnesota Sea Grant, who funded this project, they had put out a request for proposals looking at climate change. And they are really concerned about community resiliency, which basically just means how does a community respond before a flood, during a flood, and how do they recover? So what does that look like? And really, when we wrote our proposal, what we wanted to do is to be able, at the end of the day, to look at two different communities. Fond du Lac neighborhood, that's down there by Chambers Grove, so it comes out, the St. Louis River comes through Jay Cook there. that community that suffered really heavy flood damage, and then what happened up here at Fond du Lac Reservation, comparison between the two communities. And what we want to be able to do is to share the stories of what happened throughout coastal regions around the Great Lakes. So we think that we have really compelling evidence of some ways to look at community resiliency that can really help other communities. And so that's what's been really interesting about this project, is that we went into it with maybe an idea in the back of our heads of what we were going to find, and we came out the other side with very different things. And so I think that was one of the really interesting things that happened during this project. And also, when we started, the support from the Fond du Lac band that really supported and said, yes, we would really like to have that research, because, of course, we didn't want to do it unless it was something that the band thought would be useful to them. And so we have had just, we couldn't ask for more support from the band when we were trying to do this research, from community members all the way up to resources management, and then Cassie Diver in that department. It has just been a phenomenal experience, actually. So that's been a great thing, too.
So the three-year project has some interesting results to share with the community about how many were involved with this at the start to the end, and the approximate time.
Partnerships. I'll say a little bit about partnerships, and then, Carlin, I'm going to let you talk about like how many people we actually reached out to, because that's an amazing amount. So the partnerships was between Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College, University of Minnesota, and Fond du Lac Reservation, and then the community down, the Fond du Lac neighborhood community, their community, I suppose they had a, what would you call that?
They now have a Fond du Lac neighborhood club, neighborhood group that meets regularly, that really emerged from the flood itself. That didn't exist before the flood.
Yeah.
And they really came together as a neighborhood, and they now have this club.
Yeah. And then the University of Minnesota Duluth's engineering department, Rebecca Teasley, was another one. So she really looked at a lot of the infrastructure. So that was an interesting part of this, too, is look at the differences of how the infrastructure damage and recovery was also handled everywhere, you know, between these two communities. But Carlin, you want to speak of like how many people we spoke to?
Yeah, sure. We had one other partner as well, and that was Don Newman from Minnesota Extension. And Don is a tribal liaison with Minnesota Extension.
Right, yeah.
We started out, of course, we had to get permission from what's called Human Subjects Research, permission approval to be able to interview people.
I suppose some of this is kind of sensitive material that you're kind of delving into then.
Right. We didn't want to cause any risk or harm to people. And their participation in the project was completely voluntary. And in addition, we can't, we don't intend to talk about any specific individual, because we want to protect their privacy and their confidentiality. But altogether, we probably interviewed around 100 people in the two communities, Fond du Lac Neighborhood of Duluth and the Fond du Lac Reservation. In addition, I'm going to have to count all of these up, but there were probably in the neighborhood of 50, maybe even 60 officials, state, local, federal, tribal officials, that were in some way involved in the response or the recovery. And I should make it clear that there were really two phases to this. There was the actual event, the storm event itself, and probably that lasted a day or two as people were either being rescued or resettled, relocated somewhere else, and then began the long recovery process. So we really are talking about two distinct phases of this extreme weather event. And we're now, it'll be 4 years next week. We're now nearly 4 years out. And most of the infrastructure actually has been rebuilt. There are still pieces that are incomplete. There's the road down to the Fond du Lac neighborhood through 210 is still out. There are still highway and building projects, culvert projects that are still underway throughout this whole region, but lots of people, most people now at this point are back in their homes or in new homes. They've gotten, the flood is behind them. They've gone on with their lives. But we have found that for a lot of folks, they were left with a kind of a trauma, kind of an anxiety that resulted from this whole experience. I mean, they went through a lot. It was a really frightening event.
And I'm sure the residents are probably on the edge of their seats looking at the skies every time it clouds up. Maybe there's a day, maybe stretches into a couple of days of rain.
Absolutely. So that's an important learning from speaking with so many people, that if you find that you hear a siren, or you see you hear lightning, or there's a heavy rain, and you feel uncomfortable about that, you're not alone, because a lot of other people share that that same reaction. So it's a very, very common response, I would say, from the flood, and it's something that we really didn't expect at the beginning.
No, not at all.
Well, were you prepared in the back of your mind, and then all of a sudden you had to change course or something, or you just started in to see what you could come up with, or see what you would develop from it.
Right. Well, you go in to a lot of these projects and you read maybe what has happened in other areas. So you kind of, you have in the back of your mind, oh, we'll probably see something like this, But then you start talking to people, and the reality is, as Carlin said, how it came up over and over again, the unexpected reactions people had afterwards, the hyper awareness anytime there was another heavy rain, the hyper awareness of how saturated the ground was. Because, of course, the flood really in our area was a bigger event that people don't think about. It wasn't just those days, that whole 24-hour, 48-hour day. It was actually the weeks before, where we had gotten heavy rains and had saturated our ground. And so people who probably don't pay much attention to that before now are hyper aware. Oh my gosh, we've had a lot of rain. If it happens again, we've heard for several people looking at rain gauges where
even stats, because the amount of rainfall that we had, or the moisture, the content we had, is up above of the normal as of right now.
Right. And that was kind of surprising, that there is still, years after the event, hyper-awareness among people that were not that aware before. So that's a surprising,
wouldn't that be kind of good that they're being aware of this?
Absolutely. Because that's part of resiliency, too. Because that you are paying attention, so you're probably making changes that you didn't do before, so that you are more prepared in another event. And it could be simple things like the rain gutters on your house, making sure you have sump pumps, the little things that people maybe didn't do before, but they do now, and they're aware of it. There have been changes on the personal level, and of course, we were looking at the comparisons about between the two neighborhoods, of not only how people reacted, but how they were helped afterwards, immediately, and then longer term afterwards. And talk about being prepared. One of the things that we really found is the contrast between the neighborhood down, the Fond du Lac neighborhood and the Fond du Lac reservation, as far as far thinking, preparing for the future, is drastically different. The reservation has been so far thinking, organized, and if it happens again, which it probably will, knock on wood, it hope it would didn't, but it probably will. The reservation has situated itself to be so much more prepared to deal with it, to help their community, to respond to it, and then to recover from it. That Carlin had mentioned before when we were speaking, the reservation actually is a huge resource to other communities. I mean, I think that's one thing we really want to get out there is to other communities. What has been done here is a great example of how to prepare yourself for an event like this and to be able to respond quickly to it.
Carlin, we talked earlier that this 500-year event that we went through could take place in the not-too-distant future again. And there could be a number of them, and not to even rule out a 1,000-year event where what we went through just a few years ago could be more intense and either lengthier or more numerous.
Right. Okay, so what is a 500-year exceedance flood event? It means that the amount of precipitation that falls in a really excessive, a really heavy, heavy downpour is so great that you would only expect to see that happen once every 500 years. And similarly, a 1,000-year storm event would be really extraordinary. You'd only expect to see that happen once in 1,000 years, and certainly not in our lifetime. But in fact, there have been more and more of these, mainly 500-year exceedance storm events. It used to be that engineers would design sewers and culverts for 100-year exceedance storm events, but those are pretty commonplace nowadays. I mean, nobody has a crystal ball,
but it
seems as though our weather is changing and it's becoming much more unpredictable. So we're experiencing more and more excessive rainfall events. This was called a 500-year exceedance flood event. So you wouldn't expect to see a storm like this happen again for another 500 years. But again, given unpredictability, it could happen really at any time. Some climatologists are talking about 1,000-year exceedance storm events. But it could be just the opposite. It could be extreme drought. It's just that there's more unpredictability. We're getting more rainfall. We share that, actually, with the Gulf Coast, sort of the area from northern Florida all the way over to the Gulf of Mexico. Houston, New Orleans are also experiencing more extreme weather. And we are the other sort of
part of the parallel universe then.
Right. And we can learn something from New Orleans. I want to give this example of propane tanks we were talking about earlier. In the Gulf states, they also use propane, and they have local ordinances that require that propane tanks be tethered or bolted to a pad. Because if there's a flood, the propane tank, if it's not full of propane, it'll want to float. And it will break free from its connection, and then it will expel the propane, and it could move through the water. So you don't want to have a floating, moving propane tank heading toward your house or your boat or anything else. So the southern states now have learned from their flood experience that they need to tether their propane tanks. And that might be something that we can learn from them. Again, as Courtney said, God forbid that this happen again. But if it does, we actually saw a lot of the propane tanks here disconnect and float away. So that happened up here in the reservation, and it happened down in the Fond du Lac neighborhood of Duluth. So that might be something that is a take-home lesson from that.
We're talking about the update on the Climate Change Resiliency Project here with Carlin Ekman, along with Courtney Kowalczyk from the Fond du Lac Tribal Community College Environmental Institute, and also Tashi as well to join the conversation. But Carlin, getting back to some of the info that you did obtain from this Climate Change Community Resiliency Project, what data can you additionally share with our listeners?
Well, we basically asked people to tell us their stories and tell us what happened to them during the flood. And as a result of what folks told us in these, you know, sort of 100 interviews, we heard a lot about propane tanks floating around and down in the Fond du Lac neighborhood of people's docks being disconnected with boats tied to the docks and being found 8 miles downstream, and people's possessions floating around and that sort of thing. So we had an idea at the beginning that we would learn a lot about preparedness and steps people could take, if there should be another event like this. And what we ended up doing was documenting a lot of things that happened, unexpected things that we never would have imagined. I would never have imagined. I would never would have thought of floating propane tanks, but we heard a lot about that. And so that's something to take note of. And we've been actually making a list of ideas and suggestions that we've gotten from folks that we've talked with that we're going to put in our, we have to make an official report to Minnesota Sea Grant. But we'll be also doing a few other things that will be coming out from this. We're going to be doing brochures in collaboration with the Fond du Lac Band of steps that people can take in terms of preparedness and resources where they can go to get more information. We'll be doing a couple of papers and publications on this. Last week, our colleague Becky Teasley and Hannah Smith from UMD presented a paper at the International Association of Great Lakes Research up in Guelph, Ontario. So we're trying to get the word out in a number of different ways. Being here at this radio interview today is another way of getting the word out that we heard one person say, people are prepared, but maybe not enough.
Yeah, and it also brings to mind, too, and trying to be prepared for it. And if this happens, you know, like you said, God forbid again, but the highway situation, too. And, you know, people were trying to go in this direction, stopping, backing up, going to another direction. You know, great that they avoided the flooded areas, but they had no place to go.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Part of what we were looking at was this infrastructure. So that was an interesting piece to see how infrastructure, well, how it failed, and then how the communities responded to repair it. But again, it came back, a lot of this is interesting. It all comes back to communication. A lot of this is communication. How do you tell people and get that information out there? Because, mm-hmm. you know, roads are going to wash away. Changes are made to minimize this. But in flood situations like this, there's only so much you're going to be able to do. I mean, we all saw the power of the water, right? The Fond du Lac Creek and Reservation Road. It's incredible, just incredible. But it is interesting how it just comes back to how do you communicate to people for them to evacuate as safely as they can do, how they can reach people, all of that. And that's been really, really interesting.
Maybe a venue, too, where they can go to, or...
We're talking about how the band has really prepared in the future, and part of that is the shelter plans.
Mm-hmm.
That is amazing. We briefly mentioned pet sheltering, because people, you know, and you've seen that in other of these catastrophic events. People don't want to leave their pets, but you can't bring them to shelters. So how do you do that? And that's part of what the band is planning for is sheltering people, sheltering pets. How do they do that in an efficient manner? And that's again why we say the work that's going on here is really a great resource and example. Communities that need to think of all of these different pieces, and it's a lot to plan and think about. And that's part of when we say these themes that came out, it's these things that people mentioned that helps us highlight you really need to think about this, because we did have people mention they didn't want to leave their pets. So how do you deal with that in another event? You know, so.
Yeah, I'd like to say a little bit more about the work that Cassie Diver and her staff have been doing on behalf of the Fond du Lac Reservation, the Fond du Lac Band. It's been 4 years since the flood, and the memory of that flood is still very much present for all of us. But her team has been extremely busy planning for the future based on what folks have been going through the last couple of years. So there's now an emergency operations plan in place. It's been coordinated not only within the band, but also with other partners. So St. Louis County, Carlton County, the state of Minnesota with FEMA. Cassie and other staff members have gone through a lot of training from FEMA and other public agencies There's also an Everbridge system in place now so that they can sign up voluntarily and get information through that. In addition, Cassie has documented a wealth of resources that are here on the reservation as well as beyond. And that is so important to know if there is an emergency. So where are the trucks? Where are the front end loaders? Where are the people where the drivers? What are their phone numbers? So she's been documenting all of the equipment, the vehicles, the supplies that are available should there be another event, and that is all now very well in hand. And I just have the greatest respect for what they have done in terms of preparedness. I think that the Fond du Lac Band is far more prepared than other communities in this area. I just, hats off to Cassie Diver and her team, because they've just done an extraordinary job. Really extraordinary.
It's amazing. Yeah. No, it's just how well things can come together like that, and making sure that, like you said, people are in the right place at the right time down the road. Then another thing is to take about is they have all this information now. How can, you know, let's say this doesn't happen for, you know, many, many years, how can we get this from point A from here to make sure that folks down the road, down the timeline, will get this event, you know, and keep that in mind as well? How would that take place?
You know, this documentation, these plans, these relationships are what's going to make this community resilient in the face of these next steps too, because one of the things that we've seen is that continuity and departmental knowledge is huge. And unfortunately, in other communities, that's been lost. Turnover and not documenting or planning for the next person coming in after you to be able to go forward and be prepared. So that's been happening. And so I think what's been put up in place in here, what's so important, is all of the documentation and the planning in an accessible way, so that no matter who's here, they have it right in front of them, and they know how to respond to another event like that. Okay. Get that ready.
One other thing I just want to talk about as well, regarding the infrastructure, you know, the damage to that, and maybe even vegetation as well. Has that changed? The vegetation has changed, you know, consistency or content wise, where it was good soil over here, and now it's, you know, it's a different type of soil now, or what? And those things have changed as well. I don't know if Toshi wants to get involved, talk about
that. I can only say one of the member yesterday we had meeting with in the Fond du Lac Resource Management, he was talking about how the wetland has shifted.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really know how much and what are the impacts in the land, but there have definitely been some changes in the shift of the wetlands. And also some people are talking about the impact on wild rice, mm-hmm, in different lakes, and how that has affected, and what can we do in the future to prevent from that kind of thing. And also maple syrup, mm-hmm, someone's talking about, because they depend on the livelihood of making maple syrup and wild rice harvesting. So yeah, Carlin can probably talk more about the changes in vegetation.
There have been more invasive species, as I understand, from resources management, and they're the folks that are really the experts on this.
Once again, we're getting the update on the Climate Change Resiliency Project, and our thanks to Courtney Kowalczyk from the Fond du Lac Tribal Community College Environmental Institute Director, along with Carlin Ekman. And Carlin is the Research Associate at the University of Minnesota in the Twin Cities, and Toshi as well, to share some information too. But taking a look at a lot of information here in the last half hour, but taking the highlight of something that we'd like to speak about once again, Carlin.
Something that we talked about a little earlier,
sure,
and that was about how people are experiencing anxiety and uncertainty after having gone through this flood. We talked with one fellow who went through the flood and told us his story, and he was so disturbed by seeing the destruction after the flood, once the waters receded, that he left the reservation and was gone for a couple of years. And he said he was very disturbed by it. And when he came back to the reservation, he saw that everything was green again and the vegetation had regrown. And he talked about how it really made him, his heart heal, is what he said, and how he felt so much better that Mother Nature was able to heal and to recover. So I think taking the long view, I mean, the world around us, the earth is always changing. It's never inert or stagnant. It's always, always changing. And it's part of life. It's part of nature. And we have to expect that our environment is going to change. But it does recover. The earth can recover from an event like this, and people can too.
Kind of eye-opening then for you to take care of this this project then at, you know, from start to finish then, or is it not completed yet, or is there a few other things that need to be tied up here?
We're almost to the end, so mm-hmm. We will be finishing up, and like Carlin said, we're hoping to share brochures for community members, and then share in a more concise form what's happened with this project. But you say eye-opening, really on a personal level. You know, we all have our stories of what happened during the flood. And you can kind of just internalize your own story, but it really opens your heart in a lot of ways to hear other people's mm-hmm. stories too. Because, you know, you may have experienced it one way and suffered some things, but to hear how other people experienced it and suffered, really, I'm more aware of how to be prepared, but I'm also, I think, more empathetic, and I feel closer to a lot of people having heard their stories. You know, it just kind of makes you more empathetic to other people, and just opens your heart mm-hmm. after this kind of event. And I think we saw that from the stories from both communities, that one-to-one relationship between people. People just, they came together. And that, I think that is a great takeaway from this project too, because over and over in these stories, people talked about how either they were helped. Mostly they talked about how other people helped them. They didn't really, my impression from where I went, they didn't talk about how, you know, what they did to help other people. They were so grateful for the help that they got that it just makes you feel so much better about where you live, you know, when you hear those sorts of stories too.
Yeah, you hear about a 500-year flood event and you think, okay, what if we wait 500 years for the next flood? I would love to see some of these stories be passed on to the next generation, because some of these stories are really compelling. We heard just so many extraordinary things that people did and what the things that they saw, and I really hope that folks will pass that on to their children and grandchildren, and that perpetuates on into the future.
Okay, this is very interesting, and of course, these results are made available probably in the next. I don't want to guesstimate how long everything needs to be put together.
Right. We've got a couple of papers to write. We've got to write a report to mm-hmm. Minnesota Sea Grant. We'll be sharing those with tribal authorities, particularly with Cassie Diver. And we'll continue to find ways to get the word out to people about not only preparedness, but also just to reassure them about just how well the band has organized its resources and is thinking about future events. So it's, to me, it's very comforting that there are people who are doing that on our behalf mm-hmm. for all of us. But yes, we will have more things coming out in the future. Our research part is done now, and the project ends by the end of this month, but we'll be getting more information out to you over the next couple of months.
And Carlin, I was wondering if you could take a moment to share with our listeners about the Sea Grant, the various projects and research that is in progress.
Minnesota Sea Grant is part of a, a group of organizations that falls under the National Weather Service and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So it's a federal system. And Sea Grant is a collection of organizations that does research, but they fund projects, mainly research projects, but they also have a very big education and outreach component. Minnesota Sea Grant is based in Duluth and has a small staff of people, but they're concerned with coastal communities. Believe it or not, Minnesota has a coastline, and that's the coastline of Lake Superior. The coastal communities that fall within that are, they go inland as far as Fond du Lac Reservation, but it's concerned with not only water and aquatic invasive species and beach hazards and that sort of thing, pollution, water pollution, but they're also concerned with the welfare of communities that fall within Minnesota's coastline.
Does that include the watershed then?
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. St. Louis River watershed. Sure. Minnesota Sea Grant collaborates with Wisconsin Sea Grant and the other Great Lakes Sea Grant organizations, and there's also a Coastal Atlantic and Pacific Sea Grant. Some of you may have heard of land grant universities, and land grant is the terrestrial counterpart of Sea Grant. So the University of Minnesota and UMD are part of the Land Grant Association of Public Universities.
Carlin, you made mention about some beach hazards. Dare I say that would include rip currents, too?
Absolutely. So Minnesota Sea Grant has a program on riptides, pollution of beaches, sort of user awareness, that sort of thing. Jesse Schomburg is the person who has been very active in that. Doug Jensen works on aquatic invasive species. So it's a really good program. I have enjoyed working with Minnesota Sea Grant, and of course they funded our research, so we're very grateful to them for enabling us to do this work.
Hashi, do you have anything to add before we conclude here?
Well, let me tell you, I'm from Nepal. Okay. So we had like a natural disaster, earthquake last year, and over 10,000 people died. And I'm really glad to know that nobody died in 2012 in this big flood. I've seen videos, pictures, and I'm actually very amazed that nobody got severely injured or died in the incident. So I think people should not take that for granted, and it's not guaranteed that no people will die in the future. So I think they should be careful, and that's one of the main points of our research, is to prepare people. And I think the question we should ask ourselves here is not whether a flood like this will happen or not. It will. It's just when. It's about when and what will we do and what can we do to minimize the damage or the be well prepared for this kind of event. So I think all the team has done a great job. I joined just last year, but this project has been going on for 3 or 4 years now.
3 years.
Yeah, so I've learned a lot, and I think it's amazing how communities came together in times of situation like this. So with the help of our research, I hope we'll help this community, not only in the coastal communities near Lake Superior, but throughout the world, to prepare better if something like this should happen, and which most likely will happen, just a matter of when.
So, absolutely. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Tashi. Courtney, your final thoughts.
I am first of all, grateful to be involved in this project. It was very eye-opening and interesting. But again, I just can't say enough how helpful from Cassie Diver's office, resources management, all our partners, just how helpful they were, and really, I think, made this project as successful and as useful as I think it's going to be for everybody. So.
All right, Carla, we're going to wrap up our update on Climate Change Resiliency Project with you.
So many of you who are listening to this interview may have been part of our study. And as I said, there were probably at least 100 people who took the time to tell us what happened to them and what their experience was. And so we're very, very grateful that you were willing to do that and to sit down and talk about what happened to you and to your families during this time. As I said, you might have seen us at Enrollee Day, or at a, you might have met us at a, another meeting or at a workshop, but all of your stories were absolutely compelling and very interesting. We guaranteed you that we would not reveal your names, and we still promise you that everything that you told us is being kept in confidence. But your common stories add up to a much bigger story, and that is that, hey, you guys, we made it. Everybody survived. You're 4 years out, and congratulations. People really pulled through and helped each other out.
And once again, for being here today, our thanks to Courtney Kowalczyk from the Fond du Lac Tribal Community College Environmental Institute Director, and Carlin Ekman. And Carlin is the research associate at the University of Minnesota in the Twin Cities, and Tashi as well, for being here today to share with us this incredible event and put together with this Climate Change Resiliency Project the incredible story, and we thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the preceding was pre-recorded here at the studios of the radio voice of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, 89.1 FM, WGZS Cloquet.